I'm going to use double the time this time, so absolutely not. We're in chapter 4, Hebrews, and what I like about this, I've expressed my love for this chapter a little bit already, but to me, it's a bit of a, it's a letter to me, it's a letter to us, even though directly it was not, but this is a letter written by somebody who knew what they were talking about, somebody who was close to Jesus, to people who were struggling, to people who were facing issues, problems, maybe drifting away, maybe doubting what they have heard, what they once thought was completely 100% true, but now there's some doubt trickling in. And I don't know about you guys, but sometimes I can relate to hard times. Sometimes I can relate to being weary, to growing tired in this life, to sometimes feel like, am I drifting away? Am I as strong as I need to be in my walk in faith with Christ? Or maybe sometimes I see that in other people, and I just wish for them something more and something better. Somebody I go to school with, somebody I work with, somebody that's a patient of mine. And this is like a letter to me, a letter to them. And it's beautiful. It's perfect. So if you ever wondered, you know, what do I say to somebody? Or how do I get back on track? Or how do I get my friend, my family member back on track? To me, this is it. This is that letter to the people who know the truth, but they're being faced with opposition and they're drifting away. Now, to start this off, I just want to talk a little bit about, because there's some very powerful things that start this chapter. Some painful reminders, if you will. And I was watching a documentary with a prominent psychologist. And he's the number one sports psychologist in the world. He's a sports psychologist for the Seattle Seahawks. All right. Wasn't expecting that. He's the sports psychologist for people that are trying to do really, really hard things. Like the guy who jumped out of a space shuttle and skydived to Earth in a spacesuit. He was his psychologist, as well as the guy that went up as high as you can in an airplane and jumped out without a parachute. Landed on a net that he engineered for years with a guy. So these people have a lot of things mentally to overcome to try and meet these goals. And he said something powerful. He's a very humble guy, and he said, working with all these people, and I don't know if this is true, I don't know if research backs this up, but if we're ever going to change somebody, a team, a group of people, for the better, it has to start with one thing, and that is a lot of pain. Pain is that source, that beginning, that drive of change. Change can happen a lot of ways. Bad change can happen. Bad change can happen from pain as well. But directed correctly, pain is an amazing source, an amazing motivator to make really good change. So the author starts with a lot of pain sandwiched in good stuff. So we'll start here in verse 4, or chapter 4, verse 1. God's promise of entering his rest still stands, so we ought to tremble with fear that some of you might fail to experience it. The first half of that verse is fantastic, right? The promise is still there. So he's reminding the author that the promise of entering that eternal rest is still there. And then he follows it with a little bit of stirring of the hurt, a little bit of pain, a little bit of fear that you might fail to experience that rest. For this good news, once again, good stuff, this good news that God has prepared this rest has been announced to us just as it was to them. And them is the ancestors of the people who are reading this. So they're very familiar with the them here. There's stories they've heard, possibly even family members, generations before that heard the same good news, but it did them no good because they didn't share the faith of those who listened to God, or they didn't combine what they heard with faith. So I look at this, and for whatever reason, winning the lottery comes to mind a lot of times when I think of the good news. The good news that we do have that promise of entering into rest forever. But with the lottery, you still have to, yes, you win the lottery. Nobody deserves to win, correct? But it's just, you just win. It's amazing. Imagine you're sitting there on your couch and your buddy says, "Hey man, I saw your lottery ticket," slaps you and says, "You won. You won $500 million. And you're like, "Yeah, right, whatever. That can't be true." Right? So you're not even accepting that. You don't even accept the fact that you won. If you don't claim your prize, you're not going to win that. They're not going to come hunt you down and make sure that you receive this. They'll move on to the next person, right? So there are some of those people who hear the good news and they don't even accept it. But I'm sure you guys have watched the shows on TV about the people who actually win all this money and how it changes their life, it changes their environment, it changes the house they live in, it changes their friends. And what almost always happens to these people? They go right back to where they were, or sometimes even worse. Sometimes they get murdered. Sometimes their life just completely falls apart. They're bankrupt. They're worse off than they were before. So they received the good news, but it didn't change who they were. So even though they had this, pretty much on this earth, all the money you could want, and it changed everything around them, but it didn't change them internally, it made no difference. They're going to end up the same place they were, broken to begin with. And there's many scriptures I read, and I just think of that. All it's so powerful. You can have things. You can have changes happen in your life. Things can appear one way on the outside. You can hear amazing messages. But if it doesn't change you from the inside out and change the way you act and live, then we're like our ancestors. "For only we who believe can enter his rest. As for the others," God said, "in my anger I took an oath, they will never enter my place of rest, even though this rest has been ready since he made the world." So the author starts talking about this rest over and over again. And at the time, it is possible the recipients of this letter were beginning to doubt that this rest was still available. Maybe this rest was once made available to our ancestors, didn't work out for them sometimes. Maybe it was made available when Christ was here. He's gone now. Now we're facing persecution. This is getting really hard. Is this still the same story? Is this all still real for us? And I want to go back a little bit because, once again, this is most likely not first-generation Christians. This is years and years, a couple generations past. So they've seen other Christians die. They've seen other Christians be murdered. And no angels are swooping down. Jesus is not coming down and resurrecting these people. They're dying just like they did, seemingly, before Christ came. So they're starting to think, this is not quite adding up. So in Thessalonians, if we turn to 1 Thessalonians chapter 2, verse 13. It's most likely Paul who wrote this. We see some of these things repeated once again. Now this is earlier. This is to the church in Thessalonia. Similar delivering of a letter to people who are struggling, but this is even early. This is first generation Christians. And he says, "Therefore, we never stop thanking God that when you received his message from us, you didn't think our words as mere human ideas. You accepted what we said as the very word of God," which of course it is. "And this word continues to work in you who believe." So these are younger Christians. They haven't started drifting away and changing the way they act. That they were still believing. They were still acting as if, so to speak. But then you flip back over to Hebrews. This is a different group, a more mature group, or a group that should have been mature at this point, and they're starting to drift away. So even though it's very similar themes, you can see the difference. In 1 Thessalonians, it's more positive. He's not bringing the heat as much here. Verse 4. We know it is ready because of the place in scriptures where it mentions the seventh day. On the seventh day, God rested from all his work. But in the other passage, God said, they will never enter my place of rest. So God's rest is there for people to enter. But those who first heard this good news failed to enter because they disobeyed God. God set another time for entering his rest, and that time is today. God announced this through David much later in the words already quoted. Today, when you hear his voice, don't harden your hearts. So he's making sure these people who are growing weary, they know this rest is still available. 100%, it's still there for you. Why would have God talked about another rest after he have led people to a promised land? That is not a permanent rest. This is a better rest. This is the best rest. Now, if Joshua had succeeded in giving them this rest, God would have spoken about and would not have spoken about another day of rest still to come. So there's a special rest, or a Sabbath rest, still waiting for the people of God. For all who have entered into God's rest have rested from their labors, just as God did after creating the world. So let us do our best to enter that rest. But if we disobey God, as the people of Israel did, we will fall. So all these sandwiched promises, the promises are still there. But we have learned a lesson here. We do not want to revert because the author is seeing these same things repeated again. This reminds me of a powerful story I heard about 3 years ago now. Because I love the word rest. Just that word. It makes you feel good. Because who hasn't been tired? Who hasn't been physically exhausted or mentally exhausted and just thought rest would be, and maybe for some of you, right, it's right now, and you just want to go home and go to bed. But that is just, it is such an assuring thing to know that rest is coming. I know when I am in the middle of a workout or a run, I want to know when it's going to end, right? How much longer, coach? How many more reps, whatever it may be. I went to a camp one time, and it was a camp to strengthen your mind. And they said, okay, guys, we're going to run. And we got out on the road, and it's in the hills of Tennessee. And they said, take off running. And everybody's like, oh, well, how far are we going? They're like, oh, we'll come get you and tell you to turn around. So we all have to take off running, and we have no idea where we're going, how far we're going, and when we get to come back. And that I had never done that before. That is not fun. It's not fun to be in pain, agony, and not knowing when it's going to end or if, are we going to work out after this run? Are we going to do the same thing over again? We have no idea. That's why he's assuring them, rest is still there. It is coming because they are in agony right now. They are being persecuted. Life is not good. They're running. They're scared. It reminds me of a story about a guy named Cliff Young. Has anybody ever heard of Cliff Young before? Okay, good. So Cliff Young was a sheep farmer in Australia. And in 1983, he was 61 years old, had been a sheep farmer since he was a little boy. It's what he grew up doing. Well, every year, annually in Australia, they do one of the world's most elite marathons. It's from Melbourne to Sydney. It's about 550 miles, a run, nonstop run. Takes about 5 days. And the way the runners do it, they typically run for 18 hours, they sleep for six, and they do it again the next day, nonstop. In the middle of the heat, horrible conditions. So this 61-year-old shows up to the registration of this race in 1983. He's wearing overalls. He's got rubber work boots on. He's got a funny hat. And he says, I want to enter this race. And they're like, come on, old man. Like, this, I mean, these are the most elite level runners in the world. They've got sponsors. Like, Nike's out there. Helicopters are out there. The motorcycles are out there. And they're like, this guy's a joke, right? He's like, no, really, I'm going to run this. I think I can do this. And they're like, okay, you know, it's your funeral type thing. So Cliff gets entered into this race, and they line up to the starting line on the first day. 550 miles, they shoot off the gun, everybody takes out of there, and Cliff gets just blown away, left in the dust, miles and miles and miles. They're watching this Cliff guy. He can't even run. They call it the Cliff Young shuffle. He just kind of shuffles, not really jogging, not walking, shuffling. So they start worrying about his health, like, is this guy going to die out here? Like, this is not good for press. I mean, people are miles and miles ahead of him. So it's the end of the first 18-hour, the first day. The runners stop to sleep. They wake up the next day to start. When they wake up and the group starts running, they notice Cliff's not that far behind them. Like, he's within seeing distance. And so the news reporters, they get up next to Cliff and they're jogging along with him. They're like, Cliff, you know, what happened? You know, you were like 20 miles behind everybody yesterday and now you're right with the pack. They said, what'd you do last night? He said, well, I ran all night last night. And they said, well, why didn't you sleep? He said, what? He's like, you're supposed to sleep? He didn't know that most people stopped and rested for 4-6 hours. And he caught up with them. And he didn't sleep the whole 5 days. And at 61, he beat the course record and beat everybody in the field. And it's amazing because, I mean, he's wearing pants and Velcro shoes. And all he knew, and he grew up on a 2,000-acre ranch with sheep. He said, we were so poor, we didn't have horses, we didn't have tractors, so if we ever needed to get the sheep in, my parents would send me out and say, Cliff, go get all the sheep. So he'd have to run out there on foot, 2,000 acres. He said, sometimes I'd be out there 3-4 days trying to get all these sheep in. So he was used to going and doing a task that, I don't know when it's going to end, I know I'll finish it though. I know at some point I'll get all these sheep in. I know at some point this road's going to end in Sydney. And I'll get to that rest. He had no distractions. He drank glasses of milk along the way. He did everything wrong, right? He's 61 years old. Most of these people are 30 and under. And he beat everybody. And at the end, I think he won $10,000 in 1983. And he gave that. He didn't even know there was a monetary prize. And he gave that money to a couple other runners that he made relationships with. And so many times, I think, especially in this country, when we're running our race of endurance, we get caught up with all the details, you know. Like those runners, maybe they had the best shoes and, you know, they were drinking the best drinks and they were making sure they stayed cool. They're probably watching the weather. Is it a headwind? What's going to be the best day to push? Where's the end? All these details, right? Cliff had no idea. He just knew, I'm going to start this thing and I'm going to finish it. And it's probably going to hurt, but I'm going to finish it. So in life, a lot of times it distracts us. And that's where these people were. They were in the pain. And life was tearing at them, pulling at them, saying, maybe this isn't right. Maybe you should be running different. Maybe we should change the way this race is going for you. And the author comes in and says, just focus on the fact that rest is coming. And it's a rest better than anything else that's ever been explained by the word rest. A complete rest for the rest of time. So in somebody that's in agony, that is it's a special, special word, a special, special message. And now we're going to verse 12. For the word of God is alive and powerful. It is sharper than the sharpest two-edged sword, cutting between soul and spirit, between joint and marrow. It exposes our innermost thoughts and desires. Nothing in all creation is hidden from God. Everything is naked and exposed before His eyes, and He is the one to whom we are accountable. So this is a strong reminder that the Word of God is still the Word of God. It is still powerful. It still has the ability to do amazing things. And the sharpest two-edged sword. I have meditated on this and thought about this and just how powerful that statement is. So if you think about a two-edged sword, it actually has multiple meanings. A two-edged sword, what it's used for is actually piercing and entering, whether it be through metal, through armor, and entering into the deepest parts of somebody. Very efficient weapon. It's not for slicing, not for maiming, not for delimbing. It is poking through straight to the heart. But it's also a dangerous weapon to use because it has two edges on it. So it's not as safe as a single-edged sword, where you're not as likely to injure yourself with it as you use it. So the Word of God, this right here, is powerful enough to break through anything. Anybody's armor. Your own walls you put up, your friend at work, your buddy at church that's just not getting it, or whatever it may be. I love the reminder that this is sharp, it's powerful, and it can break through anything. But also, me standing here right now with this double-edged sword, it cuts both ways, so to speak. It's going to cut me as well. It's going to rip through my armor. It's going to know who I am and work within me in powerful ways better than anything else. So I want to turn here now, just pause and turn to Ephesians 6, verse 17. And you'll see this sentiment again. Put on salvation as your helmet, and take the sword of the Spirit, which is the Word of God. So it's a bolstering effect that you have this Word of God, not only as a defense, as protective armor, as to you when you're struggling, when you're being persecuted, but it's also a strong, powerful weapon. Not to do harm, but to actually cut through barriers, to break through walls, to make sure you are who you're supposed to be. So this is a strong reminder that the God of past is the same God now. The Word of God is the Word of God. It's just as powerful as it was in ancient times as it is right now. And then we talked in previous chapters in Hebrew, this separating Jesus from the other high priest. Because in that time, priests were powerful. Yearly, they went in, atoned for the sins, yada, yada, over and over and over again. And we talked how now Christ is sitting there. He is the high priest. Don't have to do that anymore. Don't have to sacrifice. That sacrifice has been made. So this beautiful message in this chapter, the hurt is stirred. They're reminded of the past, your ancestors who trailed away and were actually sworn. God took an oath against them that they're not going to enter my rest. And the author is urging them, don't do the same thing. Don't repeat history. Learn from the past. God is still God. The promise is still there. Rest is still there. So after going through that, you can imagine if you're reading this, and let's say you're guilty of some of these things. You're guilty of these thoughts. You're guilty of questioning the power of God and this new sacrifice that's better than everything else. And you look at your ancestors who weren't treated very well by God. You could be a little scared now. Wow, okay, yeah, we have messed up here. We haven't been acting right. So the author wants to assure him, the reader, of a way around that. Of a way to not be afraid to come back to God. A way that it's different now than it was in the past. So in verse 14, so then, since we have a great high priest who has entered heaven, Jesus, the Son of God, let us hold firmly to what we believe. This high priest of ours understands our weaknesses, for he faced them all the same testings we do, yet he did not sin. So let us come boldly to the throne of our gracious God. There we will receive his mercy, and we will find grace to help us when we need it most. So it's just a perfect, compact message that goes all the way to the past of, I know what you're doing. We've seen it done before. You're doing it now. You should be fearful. You should be afraid. But you can come boldly to Christ now because of Jesus Christ, who we've been talking about the past three chapters, who is the best, who is the ultimate sacrifice. And it brings it all around. And when I think of this come boldly, everybody, most people have been in some type of competitive sport before, in high school, in Little League or whatever. And everybody's probably had a bad performance, a bad game. And from the past, you probably know when I play bad, coach is on my butt, and or my parents chew me out after the game, whatever it may be, especially if I mess up a lot. So after that game, you're not walking out of the locker room or off the field like, oh yeah, that was great. Because you know you're getting ready to get it, right? So Paul knows that's what they're expecting. He knows, he's saying, look, you've had a past horrible four quarters here. Game's over, your jig is up, and I want you to still talk to God about this. But I want you to come boldly. And they're like, well, come boldly. You know, I should be cowering and coming in here afraid because I know what has happened in the past. But he says it's different now. It's not a performance sport where you have to fear retaliation. And trust me, that relationship usually isn't good like that anyways. If you've got a mom or a dad that is just on your butt after everything you do, it screws everything up. But because of Jesus, we don't have to fear that. We don't have to live in that earthly realm of father, son, mother, daughter. We are separated from that. And we get the best sacrifice. He's already gone before us. He's been faced with the same struggles we do. He's conquered them. And he's our in-between with God. And Paul wants the reader to be reminded of that. That there's still a way here. It's different than it was in the past. Today is the best day to do this. To come back to God. I want to turn now to wrap things up to 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 20 and 21. And this, once again, it's a very similar letter written by a similar author to a similar church in Corinth. And he says to them, so we are Christ's ambassadors. God is making his appeal through us. We speak for Christ when we plead. Come back to God. For God made Christ, who never sinned, to be the offering for our sin, so that we could be made right with God through Christ. So he's repeating it again and again. So when I think of if I had a letter or a message to give to somebody, because I was unfamiliar growing up with being completely separated from Christ and having to come back. I was naive to that. So when I read this and I realize I'm such a poor communicator to that person, you know, sharing this message. So to see it laid out so beautifully to somebody who's maybe never heard, you know, they're sitting on the couch and they don't believe they won the lottery. Or to somebody who has wasted it away. They've heard it and they've just ruined it. It's still here. It's still powerful today as it was the day you were born. And I think that's amazing. And it's just this chapter right here. I get a little excited about Hebrews. And this is why. Because it's you know, everybody wants to say, just tell me what to do. You know, tell me how to act. Tell me who to be. There's letters written for you, you know, with a manuscript of the mistakes people have made in the past, how to come around them, and then how to come back and be made new through Christ. Just in that chapter right there, it's laid out an example of it. A letter of urgency, but with love. Starting with a little bit of pain, stirring that, and then ending like Hebrews does with Jesus Christ. So that's it for me, guys. Thanks for being here. Thanks for listening.